safe and Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. Boris Chassaigne here with you for the next half hour. On today's last show of 2023, Indigenous youth trains for radio production.
This is a first time of its kind radio station training broadcast program. So that's exciting. The youth are doing very well. The idea is at the end of the program, they'll have full-time employment.
Oya Black Arts Coalition celebrates 5 years of helping Black creatives in Toronto.
You know, I didn't have that many mentors growing up and finding my way in this industry. And I believe it took me a long time, much longer than necessary, if I knew where to go and knew who to talk to.
Quebec confirms tuition hikes for out-of-province English university students and even adds French requirements on top of it. McGill University has decided it would foot the bill for the tuition hike.
The measures that the government released today are devastating. They are far worse than those announced on October 13th, worse for Quebec, worse for its universities, worse for Quebec businesses who need talent, and worse for McGill.
And the Calgary Ring Road is finally fully completed, ahead of schedule.
Opening this ring road means obviously new travel options for Calgarians. The road has been designed to accommodate up to 100,000 vehicles per day. And with this final section opening, drivers will save about, in the west side, 20 minutes one way.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
Follow us on X at CanadaLJI. And listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks again for keeping us company this week. Montreal, Quebec will be our first stop today. Bad news for out-of-province and international students at English universities. On Thursday, December 14, Quebec's Coalition Avenir Quebec government announced that it's going ahead with its plan to spike tuition fees for out-of-province and international students, but with a few major adjustments. Instead of raising tuition to $17,000 per year, nearly double current levels for out-of-province students, the CAC has decided to up tuition to $12,000 annually. It also introduced a new French requirement starting in fall 2025. 80% of graduating students at McGill and Concordia universities must reach Level 5 French, or the school will risk a government clawback on funding. McGill principal Deep Saini called the new measures incoherent and far worse than those announced on October 13th. More with Jules Bigel in Montreal.
It's official. Starting next fall, out-of-province tuition for incoming students will rise to $12,000 a year, an increase of about a third. François Legault announced the change on Thursday after months of pledging an even bigger hike of $17,000. That the CAC government settled on a lower figure was little comfort to McGill and Concordia, who will bear the brunt of these changes now that Bishop's University has received a partial exemption. Here's McGill Principal Deep Saini speaking to reporters Thursday afternoon.
The measures that the government released today are devastating. They are far worse than those announced on October 13th, worse for Quebec, worse for its universities, worse for Quebec businesses who need talent, and worse for McGill.
Higher Education Minister Pascal Dury has said that McGill and Concordia will remain competitive despite the hike, but Saini says that's just not realistic.
If a student that starts with zero French has to go to level five, it would take equivalent of one full semester to learn that French, and that semester has to be distributed across their degree. Then we are saying to the students, you come to McGill, pay higher tuition, twice the tuition that you would pay at a competing university, University of Toronto or University of British Columbia, but you will have to stay one extra term. You can conclude from that very easily that no student that is thinking about their financial investment and the time it would take would choose to come to McGill. They would instead go to Ontario universities or elsewhere.
He's speaking here about a new requirement on top of the higher tuition. That's a French Level 5, which 80% of students at Anglophone universities will need to obtain for the schools to avoid government penalties. That requirement, which is set to begin in fall 2025, was a surprise announcement that officials say will be difficult to reach. According to the government, Level 5 is the first intermediate step where a speaker can have a conversation with varied vocabulary. Assessing it would require tests of oral comprehension and production, most likely through online testing software. Speaking to reporters this week, Mayor Valérie Plante says she's yet to hear a convincing rationale for the province's demands, and she's worried about what the changes will do to the city of Montreal.
I'm still worried, and I've been very vocal in supporting all the ecosystem of all the universities. And so for me, I want the government of Quebec to share with us why it's okay for Bishop not to have those rules and why it remains for the universities like McGill and Concordia, you know, internationally known institution. Why do they have to follow those lines?
For his part, Premier François Legault says it's a necessary measure to protect the French language. From 2016 to 2021, the census shows a 2.4% drop in French as the first language spoken at home in Montreal.
The reality, the facts are that when you look every year, the percentage of Francophones in Montreal, it's decreasing year after year since at least 20 years. So what I'm trying to do with them, and we're hoping for discussion, is to find ways to stop this decline. And I think it's
the increase in tuition fees will go towards the Francophone network of universities, who are less able to attract international students with higher tuition fees than counterparts like McGill. International students coming to Quebec will also see their fee structure change as the government claws back more of their tuition fees to redistribute among the Francophone network. Students from Belgium and France will be exempt. McGill Principal Deep Saini told the community last week, quote, "We must prepare to navigate very difficult waters ahead. The university is set to lose out on tens of millions of dollars as a result of the changes," which Saini calls incoherent.
"We categorically reject the position of the government. It is incoherent policy based on impressions and emotions rather than evidence-based decision-making."
But only time will tell what exactly will be affected. McGill and Concordia say they're already seeing a decrease in applicants from the rest of Canada. I'm Jules Bujel. Thanks for listening.
McGill University seems to have enough of what it considers nonsense from the government and said this week it will foot the bill for the $3,000 tuition hike from its own budget so that students will not need to pay for Quebec's decision to raise fees.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
And to Toronto now. This month, the Oyo Black Arts Coalition and Media Group is celebrating 5 years of helping Black creatives get into the entertainment industry. OYA is a Toronto-based organization that provides multiple programs to Black creatives. OYA was founded by three women of color, Alison Duke, a Canadian writer, producer, director, and Gardi Conteth, an award-winning filmmaker, and Dr. Notisha Massaqua, assistant professor with the Department of Health and Society at the University of Toronto. In Toronto, here's Owen Thompson with a six-minute excerpt of this 18-minute interview with Canadian writer, producer, director Alison Duke, one of the organization's founders.
It's been 5 years helping Black people in the creative space find their foothold and find their place within the industry and diversifying it. So why is it important to have this partner program and helping Black people within the industry?
It's very important to have programs like what we do in OYA Black Arts Coalition. I've been in the industry for about 20 years, and my journey in the industry, you know, working in television, producing for television, and also as an independent artist, I see that there's not a lot of Black people at the table, not a lot of Black people getting, you know, their productions greenlit. And, you know, that causes a lot of inequity in our film and television industry. You know, we thought that we could support, you know, leveling the playing field, providing some, you know, equity seeking programs to support people who are, you know, seriously want to get into the industry, or if they were in the industry for a long time and they're in their mid-career and they just didn't know where to turn to go to the next level, you know, that we can support them as well. Yeah, and the facts are there. There's a lot of studies, you know, the breakdown of, you know, who's succeeding, who's getting hired, who gets jobs, who's doing well in this industry. And, you know, we can see that racialized communities including, or in particular, Black and Indigenous communities are faring the worst. So we thought that, you know, as we rise as a company, as a company, a for-profit company, there's something that we can do to support the next generation coming up, and also those people who are stuck and don't know what to do to get to the next level.
So you mentioned that when you first started out in the industry 20 years ago, that there were some issues and roadblocks you faced. What are some of those issues and roadblocks that you faced that you're trying to, I guess, correct with OYA and the OBAC LEAP program?
Yeah, some of the issues that I faced as a young person was finding mentors. You know, when you have very few Black people in the industry at senior levels, then there's very the pool of who you can go for mentorship is really, really small. So what we try to do is create community for those people who are out there in the industry working, you know, and achieving, you know, open their eyes to people who are looking for mentorships. And it just doesn't have to be, you know, Black people or racialized people, like all people who are willing to mentor Black creatives, just getting them to open their doors to them. And then also getting people to look at Black people to hire. Oh, sorry, a lot of the barriers are around, there's a lot of low expectations around being Black in Canada. People sometimes don't expect that you are qualified or you have the gifts that you do, even though you might be in the industry for many, many years. So, you know, doing a lot of anti-Black racism work around that. And obviously funding, you know, funding, not getting supported for your projects. And sometimes it's a matter of not getting access to the details that you might know, that details that you might need to know to actually, you know, fill out a application properly. Or maybe it's, you know, you don't have the right corporate structure or understanding of different things in the industry, like cash flow or tax credits. Like all of this information I had to learn along the way, and it was hard to find initially when I started. So now that Gaddy and I, you know, understand that, we want to share that information with other people.
When it comes to mentorship, how does mentorship help people?
Well, mentorship helps people because when you're stuck, you have someone to talk to. Or when you're wondering, you know, what to do next, you have someone to go to. And it's usually, you know, you want to pick a mentor who's been through it, who has that experience, so they can kind of guide you through the landmines of, you know, being in this industry. And there's many. And so that's very, very important. You know, I didn't have that many mentors growing up and finding my way in this industry. And I believe it took me a long time, much longer than necessary, if I, you know, knew where to go and knew who to talk to. But mentorship is really, really important. Right now, I probably mentor about, you know, 6 or 7 young people in the industry, and they're doing quite well at a faster clip than I did, getting where, you know, I am now. And it's really exciting to see. It's just having that person that you can go to who is a sounding board for, you know, your dreams and your desires in the industry, and they're able to guide you through it. And maybe even, you know, connect you with folks who can help you. You know, another aspect of being a mentor is, you know, when somebody needs some kind of like recommendation or a letter of reference, I'm there to provide it. As long as they meet the demands or, you know, meet the qualifications, I'm there to provide it. And that's really, really helpful.
So 12 more minutes of this great conversation with Alison Duke can be found on our new website, frequencynews.ca. Alison goes into the details of the workshops with their alumni, frequencynews.ca.
You're listening to Viewpoints with Boris Sasang.
Well, it's been a long time coming, but it's now complete. The final stretch of Calgary's Stoney Trail between Highway 8 and the Trans-Canada Highway finally opened on December 19th, ahead of schedule. This opening marks the completion of the decades-long project wrapping around Calgary with a 101-kilometer multi-lane freeway. The idea of a Calgary Ring Road began, if you can imagine, as far back as the 1950s. Land acquisition began in the 1970s, though construction didn't start until 1999. 197 bridges and 48 interchanges later, the Ring Road is ready to serve not only the city, but will also benefit the Tsuut'ina Nation and the entire Calgary metropolitan region. In Edmonton, Alberta, here's Ryan Hunt.
The 9-kilometer stretch of Stoney Trail between Highway 8 and the Trans-Canada Highway on the west side of Calgary has been completed, which means after over two decades of planning and construction, the Ring Road around Calgary is finally complete. Devin Dreeshan, the Minister of Transportation and Economic Corridors, gave some insight about the project.
So much work went into this project. When you tally it all up from 1999 till now, it's about over $4 billion went into the completion of this Ring Road. 101 kilometers now free-flowing around the city. So really, Christmas came early for Calgarians this year, 10 months ahead of schedule, on budget.
Dreeshan goes into depth about the completion of this leg of Stoney Trail and what it will do for the city as a whole.
Opening this Ring Road means obviously new travel options for Calgarians, seamlessly connects major highways such as the Trans-Canada, East and West, and a Highway 2 going north and south. The road has been designed to accommodate up to 100,000 vehicles per day. And with this final section opening, drivers will save about, in the west side, 20 minutes one way. And the highway also draws traffic away from heavily congested areas, whether that be the Deerfoot, 16th Ave, Glenmore Trail, and obviously Sarcee Trail. And for Calgary drivers, that means less time stuck in traffic and more time at home doing the things that they love.
Mayor Jyoti Gondek doubles down on how important the completion of the Ring Road is for not only Calgary, but for all the surrounding regions as well.
Today's announcement means we'll have better options for anyone traveling the west side of the city. It's also a significant addition to our goods movement strategy, ultimately aiding economic growth for Calgary, for the Tsuut'ina Nation, for Rocky View County, and the Calgary metropolitan region as a whole.
I'm Ryan Hunt.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
As you probably might have guessed, we here at Viewpoints and at the Community Radio Fund of Canada kind of like, if not love, the medium of radio. And that passion is being shared, of course, by people like us all over the country and on the West Coast. So when Ian Craig, for example, found a great story about a new radio training program giving youth a voice through radio, well, we kind of jumped on it. In British Columbia, Prince George's community radio station CFIS-FM and Campus FM University Radio CFIR Radio are collaborating with the Prince George Nechako Employment and Training Association to provide a 25-week hands-on training program with 6 Indigenous youth. The program will kick off in January 2024 and wrap up in July. When completed, 6 youths will be fully trained to work in radio broadcasting. Heather McKenzie, team lead for Prince George, expresses excitement, saying this is the first radio station broadcast training program of its kind. Jen Tucker at CFIR-FM said it will also be a great opportunity to share more stories to the north. Here's part of Ian Gregg's conversation with Heather McKenzie in Prince George, British Columbia. The whole interview can be found on our new website, frequencynews.ca. Disclosure, CFIR's journalist Ian Craig is funded by the Local Journalism Initiative through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Opportunities for media training are rare, especially in our region up here in the north of BC, Fraser Fort George, outside of Vancouver. The opportunities are pretty slim. There's an exciting program coming up. What about this program are you most excited for, Heather?
I'm excited about this program because our focus is the youth. Our focus is unemployed youth, and they reside within First Nation community within the 18 bands in the area of Prince George. And this is a first time of its kind radio station training broadcast program. So that's exciting. The youth are doing very well. The idea is at the end of the program, they'll have full-time employment. If they require continued training just to bring them, you know, further up to par within that business, then they would provide additional training. Or if they want to go on to do post-secondary institute into, say, they want to take on journalism, but they really like this, but it's not for them. They want to try something new. This has opportunity at the end of the program.
I understand you yourself have some background in radio. Can you tell us a little bit about the skills you picked up in that experience and how they're serving you now?
I worked for the Williams Lake First Nation. That's actually my community, my home community. And when I first started working there, the chief of the time, which was Nancy Sandy, she wanted a radio station on reserve. And I ended up moving away. And I came back years later, and I'll never forget that request that she had made. So I held fast to that plan. And as a result, I built a radio station within the Williams Lake First Nations that is in operation today. So I was the founder of it. It's a nonprofit as well. And I trained many youth that have gone through that radio station door. And as a result, one of those youth is our chief today, which is Willie Sellers.
Wow.
And he is very, very well-spoken.
The prior time that you spent within radio there, is that why you think it's important to connect youth to this experience now?
I really think it's important that the youth find their voice, and that's going to take them through life in a really good way, so that they're able to speak up and know what it is that they want to say, and to be able to have a voice. And I think that this would be an excellent way of providing that opportunity is through this radio station training program.
Considering the popularity of podcasting, sharing stories in the medium of pure audio is a rising trend, and when coupled with radio delivery, an easily accessible and affordable format, the value of being able to share perspectives, news, and stories in this way is considerable, right? But not everyone is willing to face the challenge of learning new skills and exploring these techniques, though. I'm curious, how did you find six youth who were willing to undertake the rigors of radio broadcasting? What was that process like?
Ian, I'm glad you asked that question, because it was very, very difficult, but I was determined to see this program a success. My co-workers and I, we did a lot of legwork, and the idea, my immediate supervisor, just Karen Hunt, she was really liking the idea of having a radio station broadcast training program for our youth. So I said, okay, we're going to do it. So we just kept hammering the communities to, you know, provide us some youth and take this out. We really had to dress it up and offer other opportunities, not just a radio station training. So they'll have their driver's license by the end of this program if they don't already. They'll also have life skills. We provided them funding so that they could buy new clothing, any kind of supplies that they may need to undertake this training program. We provided them a place to live, which is out of the community and just a little ways out of town, not far. We have hired a project coordinator who drives them to the program every day. She'll come in, make sure they have their lunches, their breakfasts packed, and away they go.
How far away are people coming from for this program?
As far as Fort St. John, they're at Fort St. James, Fraser Lake, Clately Tanay, which is the Shelley Band. It's about 20 minutes out, but there's a variety, so near and far.
Oh, this is a very exciting prospect. If the program meets success, do you foresee ways of sustaining it so more opportunities arise for this cohort or perhaps even a new crop of interested youth?
Yes, absolutely. And that was one of the project plans when we first started talking, that we said, well, let's get this one rolled through. We'll hit a few bumps and snags along the way, but the next one after this one, they'll just keep getting better and better. And I take my hat off to Genevieve, the radio station manager of CFER, and Reg Fayer, the executive director of the Caribou FM station downtown. Those two work really well together, and they just developed the curriculum. Boom, it was done. And they just work so well with the students. I'm just so appreciative.
There's talent abound. These community connections bring community together.
Yes.
We zoom over to CFUR 88.7 FM to talk to the station manager, Jen Tucker, about her perspective on the value of such a program on a small nonprofit radio station.
I'm really excited to be a part of this program, and I think it's super important to just teach and show our skills that we have in this realm to as many people as possible. And what an incredible opportunity to do that, especially with young people. But also, I think it's important to note that they could potentially be working for CFER in some capacity after this. So it's really great for the station to have that opportunity to have more people that are trained, especially right underneath us as a nonprofit here. It'll also be a great opportunity just to share more stories to the north from different perspectives. And yeah, we're really looking forward to having the opportunity to do that.
You mentioned bringing these skills into northern BC. How do you think the community at large would benefit?
Because it's such a new program, I think the community at large will benefit because there's going to be a lot of other people that are going to hear about this after this first program ends, and hopefully we can continue on with it and get more people to join in and be a part of it the next time around. I feel like radio is something that not a lot of people think of as like a career opportunity, so I think this is a great way to share those skills.
This is Ian Gregg. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program.
And that's it for us this week at Viewpoints. For the next couple of weeks, we'll be airing reruns of the show. I want to take a few seconds to first thank our journalists this week, Ryan Hunt, Owen Thompson, Ian Craig, and Jules Bugiel. National editors are Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Many thanks to all our journalists who were part of our shows this year. And you know what? There were more than 40 journalists from all across the country producing great work. And to our Ottawa team at the Community Radio Fund of Canada, which produces Viewpoints, Alex Friedman, Emmanuel Sayer, Francella Fialos, Anta Basdial, and to Stéphane Bénard, our other national editor in French. And cheers to you who keep us company and to your local radio station. Thank you very much. We leave you with this interpretation of Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, written by Ryuichi Sakamoto, interpreted at the harp by Lara Somoji. Happy holidays, peace, love, joy, and friendship to each and every one of you. See you next year. Ciao.